years, Warren worked on more literary first-person games, which he termed immersive simulations. Titles like Ultima Underworld, Thief, and System Shock relied more on a player's intellect and stealth than on the trigger finger. Romero thought he'd be a perfect fit. Warren signed on to head up his own development team in what would become Ion Austin. He set to work on an idea for his own dream product, a sci-fi counter-terrorist game that would be a most realistic and gripping immersive simulation. The title was Deus Ex. When Romero's public relations company tried to pull Warren into the fray, however, he was quick to draw a line in the sand. "I will never say the words, suck it down," he told them, "and I don't want to make anybody my bitch. We're going to be the classy part of this company. Just get ready for it." Mike Wilson was less than concerned about how he himself was coming off. At a video game industry trade show in England in September, he called a meeting with the executives of Eidos and presented them with an outline of Ion Storm's next three games. "Here they are," he said. "Take them or leave them." Mike had squeezed publishers in the past, particularly with the Quake shareware deal that essentially cut out GTI and the retailers. The Eidos executives didn't even discuss the plan. Who the hell did Mike think he was? Ion Storm was already behind on their first three titles, and now they wanted to talk about their next three? No deal was struck. Todd Porter told the other owners that after the meeting, he received a call from the Eidos CEO threatening to strangle Mike. Todd, who had long been against the idea of burning through the Eidos options, complained to Romero and Tom, but to no avail. They were too immersed in their games, he thought, to tend the store. So he decided to tend it himself. He didn't like what he found. Mike and the chief operating officer, Bob Wright, he thought, were recklessly spending cash without keeping clear tabs. But while Todd was moving in against them, Mike was taking similar steps against Todd. Easygoing and fun-loving, Mike had quickly become something of a mentor to the young gamers at Ion Storm, and they were opening up to him about their increased dismay. Todd and his Dominion team were a pain in the ass, they said. So were Jerry's artists. A culture clash was emerging. While Romero's team was composed of young gamers from the Doom community, Todd's and Jerry's teams were older and more removed. Todd had hired a few PhDs. Few of Romero's gamers had even graduated from college. Worse, Todd's guys didn't know the game that had made Ion Storm possible. Romero's crew was shocked that a guy from Todd's team didn't even recognize Doom when it was being played on someone's machine. After hearing these complaints daily, Mike decided something had to be done. In October, he took Romero and Tom to a bar and told them the things that their own staffs had been afraid to say. Everyone hated Todd. Dominion, despite his assurances, was taking longer than 6 weeks and wasn't looking too impressive. Todd didn't fit in with the company. He was wearing business suits to work, for Christ's sake. They agreed to let Todd go. The next week, on the elevator to tell Todd the news, however, Romero backed down. "Man, I can't do it," he told Mike. "I don't feel like we've given him a chance, and we're just firing him because everybody hates him. We should just talk to him and lay down some ultimatums and offer to help him." Mike was shocked. Romero had flipped his bit again. But Mike didn't realize just what the implications of that flip would mean. The next month, Mike was called into a meeting himself. The owners, particularly Todd, had had enough with him. Eidos was calling every day and saying how much they couldn't stand working with him, and they had discovered some problems. Without the owner's knowledge, Wilson had borrowed company money to buy a new BMW. Furthermore, the self-publishing deal was just too out of focus. Ion Storm didn't need to publish games, Romero said. It needed to make games. And if Mike was dead set on being a publisher, then Mike would have to go. He went. With Mike out of the picture, Romero could buckle down and lead his team to the completion of the task at hand. By February 1998, he got what he had been waiting for, the Quake 2 code. It was the stuff that would enable them to put the completion of Daikatana into high gear. But when Romero opened the file, he took one look at the code and froze. Oh my God, he thought. What had Carmack done? "Do you have some aspirin?" Carmack asked his friend as they walked into a casino in Las Vegas. "Do you have a headache?" "No," Carmack said, "but I will soon." It was February 8, 1998, and Carmack was about to put his brain to the test, counting cards in blackjack. This had become something of a new fascination of his. Having a reasonable grounding in statistics and probability, and no belief in luck, fate, karma, or gods, "the only casino game that interests me is blackjack," he wrote in a dot plan file. "Playing blackjack properly is a test of personal discipline. It takes a small amount of skill to know the right plays and count the cards, but the hard part is making yourself consistently behave like a robot rather than succumbing to your gut instincts." To refine his skill before the trip, Carmack applied his usual learning approach, consuming a few books on the subject and composing a computer program, in this case, one that simulated the statistics of blackjack dealt cards. His research proved successful, netting him $20,000, which he donated to the Free Software Foundation, an organization of like-minded believers in the hacker ethic. "It's not like I'm trying to make a living at blackjack," Carmack wrote online after his trip, "so the chance of getting kicked out doesn't bother me too much." It didn't take long for him to find out just how he'd feel. On the next trip, Carmack was approached by three men in dark suits who said, "We'd appreciate if you'd play any other game than blackjack." The others at the table watched in disbelief. "Why are they doing this to you?" a woman asked. "They think I'm counting cards," Carmack said. "They think you can remember all those different cards?" "Yeah," Carmack replied, "something like that." "Well, what do you do?" "I'm a computer programmer," he said, as he was escorted out the door. Casinos weren't the only places Carmack sought escape in February 1998. His old desire for monkish seclusion brought him rather spontaneously one day to a small, anonymous hotel room somewhere in Florida. Despite the glowing reviews and great sales of Quake 2, the stress of the office had finally proven too great. All the infighting, the bitching, the moaning, the real-life deathmatches between the increasingly dissatisfied staff. Things had gotten so bad that they even worked their way into the game. A secret level created by Tim Willits contained portraits of each id member on the wall. Each portrait triggered some type of animation that, in Tim's mind, reflected the personality of the staffer. Carmack's disappeared into the floor when anyone approached. Now Carmack had vanished for real, sequestering himself in this faraway hotel room for a week. Pizza boxes littered the floor. The phone didn't ring. The door didn't open. The only distraction was when his throat dried out so much that he had to venture outside for another Diet Coke. He had even bought a special laptop for the occasion, a Dolch portable Pentium 2 system with full-length PCI slots, just roomy enough for his Evans & Sutherland OpenGL accelerator. Ostensibly, he had come here to research what he was calling his Trinity Engine, a new leap of a graphics system that he would develop while the rest of the team churned out a mission pack for Quake 2. But when he arrived back in Mesquite the next week, he found himself as well with an uncommon need to reflect in a dot plan file he posted online. Name: John Carmack. Description: programmer. Project: Quake 2. Last updated: 02-1998, 03-06-55 Central Standard Time. Okay, I'm overdue for an update. The research getaway went well. In the space of a week, I only left my hotel to buy Diet Coke. It seems to have spoiled me a bit. The little distractions in the office grate on me a bit more since. I will likely make week-long research excursions a fairly regular thing during non-crunch time. Once a quarter sounds about right. I'm not ready to talk specifically about what I am working on for Trinity. Quake went through many false starts, beam trees, portals, etc., before settling down on its final architecture, so I know that the odds are good that what I am doing now won't actually be used in the final product, and I don't want to mention anything that could be taken as an implied promise by some people. I'm very excited by all the prospects, though. Many game developers are in it only for the final product, and the process is just what they have to go through to get there. I respect that, but my motivation is a bit different. For me, while I do take a lot of pride in shipping a great product, the achievements along the way are more memorable. I don't remember any of our older product releases, but I remember the important insights all the way back to using CRTC wraparound for infinite smooth scrolling and keying. Actually, all the way back to understanding the virtues of structures over parallel arrays in Apple II assembly language. Knowledge builds on knowledge. I wind up categorizing periods of my life by how rich my learning experiences were at the time. My basic skills built up during school on Apple II computers, but my lack of resources limited how far and fast I could go. The situation is so much better for programmers today. A cheap used PC, a Linux CD, and an internet account, and you have all the tools and resources necessary to work your way to any level of programming skill you want to shoot for. My first 6 months at SoftDisk working on the PC was an incredible learning experience. For the first time, I was around a couple of programmers with more experience than I had, Romero and Lane Roth. There were a lot of books and materials available, and I could devote my full and undivided attention to programming. I had a great time. The 2 years following, culminating in Doom and the various video game console work I did, was a steady increase in skills and knowledge along several fronts. More graphics, networking, Unix, compiler writing, cross-development, RISC architectures, etc. The first year of Quake's development was awesome. I got to try so many new things, and I had Michael Abrash as my sounding board. It would probably surprise many classically trained graphics programmers how little I knew about conventional 3D when I wrote Doom. Hell, I had problems properly clipping wall polygons, which is where all the polar coordinate nonsense came from. Quake forced me to learn things right, as well as find some new innovations. The last 6 months of Quake's development was mostly pain and suffering trying to get the damn thing finished. It was all worth it in the end, but I don't look back at it all that fondly. The development cycle of Quake 2 had some moderate learning experiences for me. GL Quake, Quake World, Radiosity, OpenGL Tool Programming, Win32, etc. But it also gave my mind time to sift through a lot of things before getting ready to really push ahead. I think that the upcoming development cycle for Trinity is going to be at least as rewarding as Quake's was. I am reaching deep levels of understanding on some topics, and I am branching out into several completely new non-graphics areas for me that should cross-pollinate well with everything else I am doing. There should also be a killer game at the end of it. Smiley face. The good mood didn't last. Like Romero at IonStorm, Carmack was discovering that the glory days of a small team and easy chemistry were gone. In their place was a palpable atmosphere of bitterness and dysfunction. The tension between Tim, American, and the other level designers had reached a boiling point. Adrian and Kevin were battling with Paul Steed. They disliked each other too strongly to work closely together on the mission pack, Carmack realized. The solution? Build the next game around the company's animosity. Quake 3 would be a deathmatch-only title, using most of his ideas for the Trinity engine. That would allow the map designers to work in complete isolation from each other. Carmack's idea did not go over well. Adrian was vocally upset with yet another Marines and Shotguns shoot-em-up game. He felt like they had been making the same title for years, and he wanted something different. So did American. Paul agreed, lobbying to do a title that had more of a story, more characters, more freshness. He drafted a long design document detailing a story for the game. Carmack shot it down, saying that story was not important. Even Kevin, long the ultimate team player of the group, expressed his dismay, telling Carmack that if he wanted to do this game, he'd have to find a different project manager. This was Carmack's company now more than ever. Quake 3 would be Carmack's game. For American, it was the beginning of the end. He was called into a meeting with the owners and told that he was being fired for not performing. Carmack thought American had served his purpose, but had now gone the route of Romero. When American wanted more of an explanation, he was told, ultimately, that it was because no one liked him. Typical, he thought, It was indicative of what the company had become since Romero had left. There was no balance anymore. He wasn't the only one feeling newfound empathy for Romero. Even though Paul Steed had never worked with him, he was beginning to think that firing Romero had been a terrible mistake. "Romero is chaos and Carmack is order," he said. "Together, they made the ultimate mix. But when you take them away from each other, what's left?" The emerald green elevator doors slid open on the penthouse of the Texas Commerce Building. In February 1998, Romero stepped out to see at last the completed renovation of his Willy Wonka factory. Everything he had imagined was there. The game room with the vintage arcade machines, the foosball, the pool table, a deathmatch arena with shiny 21-inch monitors wrapped around a fine oak kiosk, a bank of 12 television sets flashing MTV, a maze of corrugated steel cubicles that resembled a level of a game, a kitchen overflowing with candy and junk food, and, wrapping around and on top of the 22,500 square feet, windows that scraped the clouds. Romero took it all in and had one thought. "Holy shit, we gotta fucking make some great games." They needed to make great games because the expenses, Romero knew, were even greater. The office renovations had cost over $2.5 million. Dominion, which was supposed to have taken only 6 weeks to complete, had eaten up more than $3 million. The original $13 million was gone, and Eidos was now sending in cash on a monthly run rate. Between the lease, the salaries for the nearly 100 employees and the other expenses, the bills were nearly $1.2 million per month. But there was another problem. A big problem. Carmack's Quake 2 code. The engine was completely different than what he had expected. All this time, he'd had his programmers preparing Daikatana in a way that would make it easy to switch over to what he assumed Carmack's new engine would require. But it turned out that Carmack had trashed his expected direction and instead produced a structure of code that caught Romero completely by surprise. It certainly wasn't done to dupe Romero into a delay. It was just Carmack making his own idiosyncratic intuitive leap. A leap that, once again, cramped Romero's grand designs. "This is going to take a while," Romero told Eidos and his staff. "This code is jacked." Completing Daikatana for his promised March 1998 deadline was impossible, but Romero thought they could turn it around in a few months. Others weren't so confident, lobbying him to forget about competing with id's technology and just release the game using the original Quake engine. "You can't keep up with Carmack," said Romero's lead programmer, "so why even try?" But Romero wouldn't waver. His ambitions only grew larger. Later that month, Romero told the gaming press that Ion Storm was going to begin work on Daikatana 2. Co-owners Todd Porter and Jerry O'Flaherty initiated a plan of their own to launch a comic book division within the company using the artists of Jerry's who had worked in that industry. The owners approved the plan to hire up a staff and release a comic book for each of the company's games as, essentially, free public relations. When Eidos got wind of the plan, however, they immediately shut it down. "You guys are supposed to be making games," they said. "Why should we pay you to make comics?" Even the glass ceiling they toiled beneath became a problem. Specifically, a nightmare of light. Next to vampires, no one hates the light as much as gamers. There's nothing worse than a big, bad glare blinding down on a computer screen. Nobody could work. The architects were immediately called in to install stylish spoilers on top of the cubicles, but they proved hardly dark enough to suit the gamers' finicky tastes. Instead, they caravanned to Home Depot and returned on a mission. They whipped out the staple guns and fashioned thick sheets of black felt over every cube in the office. They didn't just work in the shade, they worked in the black. To get into their cubes, they had to part their drapes of felt like photographers entering miniature darkrooms. It became an awesome and ironic sight. Walk through the glass dome of Gamer's Paradise, and all one saw were rows of caves. By the spring of 1998, the mood around the company was growing similarly black. Despite their working in what felt like perpetual crunch mode, 12-hour days, 6 days a week, Daikatana was nowhere near being done. Many felt the project was out of control. One guy produced a series of levels that proved unusable. An artist created a graphical icon for an arrow in the game that was 1,000 times the appropriate size. Factions within the Daikatana team began breaking apart. Even Romero's most devout fans, Will LeConte, Sver Cavernmo, and about a half dozen others, began getting more clandestine, opting out of rambunctious death matches and keeping to themselves. Others started lashing out. One employee was found alone at his desk, screaming. Romero fired him. But more were concerned about Todd Porter's and Jerry O'Flaherty's increased sense of ownership. The two, they felt, were running the company into the ground. Todd had been showing up more frequently at Daikatana meetings, making what they thought were fruitless suggestions about how to alter the game. Meanwhile, Dominion was a shambles to their minds, a sorry-looking title that was, unfortunately, going to be Ion Storm's first release. They soon took action. On May 13th, Sver, Will, and 6 other members of Romero's team asked Bob Wright, Ion's chief operating officer, whom they had perceived as an ally back when he was working closely with Mike Wilson, to join them for lunch. They had an ultimatum for Romero, they said. Todd and Jerry had to go, or they would walk out the door. Bob urged them to put their complaints in writing. Word about the meeting leaked back to Tom Hall. Bob had told the guys that he could help them to finance their own company if they did quit or get fired. Tom called Romero. It was bad timing. Romero was out of the office with his wife, Beth, who had just given birth to their first child, Lilia. He had been on something of a roll in his family life, having convinced his ex-wife Kelly to move with his boys, Stephen and Michael, to Texas so he could see his sons more often. Before long, he was right there by their side, playing games. The birth of his daughter was supposed to be a joyous day. But there was another fate in store. "What the fuck?" Romero screamed when Tom told him about Bob's interference. "That's it. Bob fucked with my team. He's gone." Bob was fired the next week. But this didn't begin to quell Ion's burgeoning problems. The company once again had a disappointing showing at E3, which took place the last week of May. Competing shooters, such as the recently released Unreal and the upcoming Half-Life, garnered most of the attention, as did id's upcoming game, Quake 3. When Ion Storm's Dominion hit shelves the following week, it flopped. Another fantasy-based strategy game, StarCraft, had been released to rave reviews just a couple months before and made Todd's title look stale. Not only did it die in the marketplace, but it confirmed to the already bitter gaming community that all might not be well in Romero's Dream Factory. And that community, the very people who had grown up on Romero's games, bit back. On game sites with names such as Evil Avatar, Sugar Shack, Blues News, and Daily Radar, players had a feeding frenzy around Ion Storm. "All talk, no game," a typical post read. "Reasons I won't buy Daikatana," read another. A comic strip online lampooned Romero with long hair, saying, "Hi, I'm here to tell you that Daikatana will be great. You guys know I'm good for it. Like Doom. You remember Doom? I did that. And Quake, right? That was me too. Design is law." The final frame showed that Romero was, in fact, pitching a hot dog seller to get a free meal. "Nice try, John," the vendor replied. "No game, no wiener." Another death rumor surfaced. This time it came after a photo of Romero in a morgue with a bullet hole in his head leaked onto the web. Gamers joked that he'd killed himself after losing a Quake game to Carmack. But when a gaming magazine online issued, and later retracted, a report that sources at Ion Storm confirmed Romero's demise, gamers went ballistic. Still reeling from the bitch ad, they resented what seemed to be another publicity stunt, despite the fact that the leaked photo had actually come from an upcoming Texas Monthly magazine article about Ion Storm. The biggest blow came on September 30th, when a scribe named Bitch X posted on a site called Gaming Insider broke news of a plan by Eidos to buy IonStorm. For months now, the owners had been in talks with their publisher to hatch some kind of bailout plan. The idea had started back in May, with Eidos buying 19% of IonStorm's equity for $12.5 million in exchange for forgiving the $15 million advance. Ion's royalty would be lowered from 40 to 25% as well. Bob Wright would even sue the company, alleging that they'd fired him specifically to cut him out of profiting from the Eidos deal. Months later, the deal was still being negotiated. How Bitch X knew, no one could surmise. When, over the next couple of weeks, the bitch talked of various firings and emails at IonStorm, the guy who ran IonStorm's website told the owners, "Either people who are no longer with the company know a whole lot more than the people who are here, or we've got a leak that the Titanic can sail through." No one admitted to leaking the news, so Romero tried unsuccessfully tracing employees' email activity to see who might be sending information to the sites in question. But the damage was done. The company grew rife with suspicion and distrust. The employees began to grumble quite loudly about IonStorm's financial future. From the beginning, they had expected to be cut into some kind of royalty or bonus or ownership. And the more rumors spread, the more depression set in. Romero confronted his lead programmer, Key Kimbrell, who had co-founded Duango, one day for playing too many games and not getting his work done, a complaint whose irony didn't go unnoticed. "What the fuck, dude?" Romero said. "You stopped working, and we need to get this game done. It's serious, you know." He told Romero he was worried about the business. He had seen a spreadsheet of IonStorm's financials and had been hearing rumors that Eidos was going to shut the company down. Romero exploded. "Rumor, rumor, 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 bullshit!" he said. "You don't understand business. Don't try to fuck with business stuff. You don't understand the deal that we have with Eidos. You don't understand a lot of things. You're letting it affect the way that you are not working, and you're bringing other people down and all this shit." But Key wouldn't back down, and Romero fired him on the spot. It would get worse. Employees began walking out the door, not to return. The deal with Eidos fell apart, just as it was about to be signed, due, in no small part, to the increased delays and chaos within the glass walls. With the failure of Dominion and the need to keep Ion afloat, Todd relinquished plans to work on Doppelganger and immersed himself in his new position as CEO. Romero, he thought, was too non-confrontational. So Todd hired an auditing firm to make sense of Ion's hemorrhaging financials. Despite knowing that his own aggressive style could alienate those around him, he felt obliged to get the Daikatana team back into shape, but it was to no avail. Romero refused his suggestions to cut the game, and the employees only became more embittered at Todd's increasingly vocal lashings. They resented the fact that, one day, while they watched a building go down in flames nearby from their perch, Todd exclaimed, "We're not paying you to watch a building burn." By the fall, Ion was headed for a conflagration of its own. On the evening of November 18th, Romero was taken out to P.F. Chang's for dinner by Stevie Case and a couple of other trusted employees. Since Stevie was hired, she had remained loyal to Romero, providing solace and perspective during the increasingly hard times. "We heard a rumor," she said, "that your entire Daikatana team is going to leave tomorrow." Romero remained defiant. "Fuck them if they're going to leave," he said. The next day, Romero and Tom were called into the conference room, where they found the Daikatana team waiting. "We can't keep working under these conditions," they were told by Will Leconto. "We don't think this game is ever going to get done, so we're going to go and start our own company." Romero wandered back through the maze of cubicles and sat down at his desk, where he would remain long after the sun came down on the glass tower. "Everything is bullshit," he thought. "Why did I hire these people? It shouldn't have been this big. This was too many people, too much money. It should have been just me and Tom and a small team of people with a common goal. It should have been like the way it was when we weren't biz guys. We were just gamers. Chapter 15. Straight Out of Doom. As gamers came, Reb Doomer wasn't unique. He loved first-person shooters, especially Doom and Quake. He stayed up late at night, deathmatching over the internet. He made amateurish mods, an arena space based on a hockey rink, a boxing ring for hand-to-hand combat, and traded them with friends online. "What's up, all you Doomers out there?" he typed to them. "Reb here, bringing you another kick-ass Doom 2 wad. This one took a damn long time to do, so send me some bloody credit, man." Offline, he wasn't finding much camaraderie at all. He was deeply troubled at school. The jocks, the jokes, the feeling of being a pariah. He began keeping increasingly angry journals, venting his desires for revenge. Finally, one day he set up a video camera in his basement, then sat in a reclining chair, holding a bottle of Jack Daniels and a sawed-off shotgun in his lap. Looking into the camera, he described his plan to go on a shooting spree through his high school. "It's going to be like fucking Doom," he said. "Tick, tick, 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 ha! That fucking shotgun is straight out of Doom." On the morning of April 20th, 1999, Eric Reb Doomer Harris and his best friend, Dylan Vodka Klebold, strapped themselves with bombs and shotguns and went on a rampage through their Littleton, Colorado school, Columbine High, leaving 15 people, including themselves, dead. The event, which played out on live television, galvanized the country. Parents, teachers, politicians, and children wanted to make sense of the ultimate senseless act. They were looking for something to blame. At 5:15 p.m. on April 21st, 1999, Steve Heaslip, the editor of a game news site called Blues News, uploaded a message. "Several readers have written in reporting having seen televised news reports showing the Doom logo on something visible through clear bags containing materials said to be related to the suspected shooters. There is no word yet of what connection anyone is drawing between these materials and this case. As the killer's Doom books, Doom games, and Doom fantasies surfaced, the connection was made soon enough. In the weeks following the tragedy, Doom became emblematic of how violent media were inspiring real-life violence. The Simon Wiesenthal Center issued a report suggesting the Eric Harris had reconfigured Doom in a dry run of the real-life killings. Similarly, without substantiation, others began reporting that Harris had created a mod based specifically on Columbine High. The Washington Post described the world of Doom deathmatching as a dark, dangerous place. Newsday wrote about how playing Doom can widen the hole in any kid's soul. David Grossman, a former Army Ranger, became a media darling for his views on games as murder simulators. Even President Clinton chimed in, quoting Grossman in a radio address and adding that Doom, the very game played obsessively by the two young men who ended so many lives in Littleton, makes our children more active participants in simulated violence. Once again, violent games and their associated pop culture, black clothes, heavy metal, gory films, were under attack. The mayor of Denver asked promoters to cancel a concert by Harris's and Klebold's alleged favorite band, Marilyn Manson. Schools banned trench coats. Disney World and Disneyland pulled violent video games from their arcades. But none took the call to arms like the senator who had initiated the country's first investigation into violent video games 6 years earlier, Senator Joseph Lieberman. In an April 28th statement, he called for a new investigation into the scourge. "My hope," he said, "is that such a summit would persuade the nation's top cultural producers to call a ceasefire in the virtual arms race, to stop the release of ultra-violent video games and movies and CDs that romanticize and sanitize extreme forms of violence, and teach our children that killing is cool, the very material, such as Doom, that several of the school gunmen murderously mimicked, down to the choice of weapons and apparel. Without any sensible counterpoint, the press and politicians, many of whom had never played such games, were left to draw their own conclusions. Ellen Goodman, in her nationally syndicated column, asked, "How many of us accept as normal boy stuff the video games that we are now told are virtual training sessions for military desensitization?" She didn't seem to know or care that the military didn't use the games to desensitize. They used them for team building. Good Morning America corralled a friend of the teenage killers who led the viewers through a game of Doom. "There's more to learn from Eric Harris's computer game," the reporter intoned. "Watch closely as we enter the secret rooms he created." There were bodies hanging from the ceiling. Images, he implied, that Harris had created. In fact, they were the original B-movie effects of the game. "This is like walking through somebody's nightmare," the reporter declared. "Did it ever strike you that, hey, this is a little strange, this guy really likes all this blood and shooting and violence?" His friend replied, "Never. He was just a gamer." And these were just games. It was an obvious point among the people who actually played Doom and Quake, but one that seemed strangely to elude everyone else. Games were make-believe. In video games, no one really got hurt. But when it came to violent play, people had a history of linking fantasy with reality. As the author Gerard Jones explored in his book, Killing Monsters, Why Children Need Fantasy, Superheroes, and Make-Believe Violence. As Jones noted, an influential study in 1963 found that children who watched films of a person punching an inflatable clown doll later beat up such a clown toy more aggressively than kids who hadn't watched the film. The conclusion? Exposure to violent media caused real-life violence. In reality, of course, the kids were just punching inflatable clowns. They were not running to the local circus and pummeling Bozo. Rather than blame violent media, Jones argued, adults needed to understand the role make-believe violence plays in human development. Exploring, in a safe and controlled context, what is impossible or too dangerous or forbidden is a crucial tool in accepting the limits of reality. Playing with rage is a valuable way to reduce its power. Being evil and destructive in imagination is a vital compensation for the wildness we all have to surrender on our way to being good people. Researchers since the 1980s had been finding positive effects of video games. A report in the Journal of American Academic Child Psychiatry argued that games not only didn't inspire aggression, they released it. An academic study in England would find that gamers seemed able to focus on what they were doing much better than other people and also had better general coordination. Overall, there was a huge similarity with top-level athletes. The skills they learned on computers seemed to transfer to the real world. In Finland, researchers used computer games to help treat children with dyslexia. And, despite all the studies that attempted to link violent media with aggression, the conclusions remained suspect. Violence in film, in video games, in music lyrics, is disturbing to us all, Dr. Stuart Fischoff, founder of the Media Psychology Lab at California State University in Los Angeles, said in an address to the American Psychological Association later in 1999. But because two phenomena are both disturbing and coincident in time, does not make them causally connected. There is not, I submit, a single research study which is even remotely predictive of events like the Columbine Massacre. Murderers, after all, had proven that they could find inspiration in anything. The White Album, Taxi Driver, Catcher in the Rye. How many acts of violence had the Bible inspired? After Columbine, however, few had the nerve or the knowledge to defend games. John Katz, a writer for Rolling Stone and the tech community Slashdot, posted several essays that assailed the media's stereotypes of geeks and gamers. "This is so crazy and hysterical," he told the San Francisco Chronicle. "The real issue should be how teenagers get their hands on machine guns and bombs, not about a website and video games." Others offered backhanded defense at best. "Violence has always been a big thing in the U.S., wrote Time, "and there are good constitutional reasons why we can't legislate that out of our entertainment products. But the video game industry makes only what it can sell. And as long as gore is what we're buying, for our kids and for ourselves, gore is what they'll give us." The politicians, however, weren't going to wait for the people to decide matters for themselves. Sam Brownback, a Republican from Kansas, made a speech on the Senate floor saying, "The video game Quake, put out by id Software, the same company as the producer of Doom, consists of a lone gunman confronting a variety of monsters. For every kill, he gets points. As he advances in the game, the weapons he uses grow more powerful and more gory. He trades in his shotgun for an automatic, and later gets to use a chainsaw on his enemies. The more skilled the player, the gorier the weapons he gets to use. Bloodshed, his reward." By June 1999, the White House had stepped up to the plate. During a press conference in the Rose Garden, a dour-faced President Clinton stood holding up an ad from a gaming magazine that promoted a game as "more fun than shooting your neighbor's cat." "We ought to think twice," he said, "about the impacts of ads for so-called first-person shooter video games, like the recent ad for a game that invites players to, and I quote, get in touch with your gun-toting, cold-blooded, murdering side." With that, he ordered a federal investigation to determine whether gaming and other entertainment companies were guilty of marketing violent products to children. The industry's assertion that games were being made in part by and for adults didn't ring true. "It's hard to argue with a straight face that the games were made for adults in the first place," he said. 3 days later, Senators Lieberman and John McCain announced a solution: the 21st Century Media Responsibility Act, a formidable bill that would establish a standardized rating system for movies, music, and video games. If the bill passed, retailers who sold violent games to minors would face $10,000 fines. No one in the games industry opposed ratings. They already had their own voluntary entertainment software rating board. But of course, they bristled at standardization and government involvement. The message from Washington was loud and clear: rethink violent games or else. It was 1:34 a.m. in Suite 666, days after the Columbine shootings. Carmack sat at his desk behind the black windows in the black night, cursor blinking on his computer, awaiting a response. He thought over his words carefully. Writing his dot plan updates was becoming increasingly laborious because, as Carmack knew, everyone seemed to be hanging so much on what he said. "Some of you," he finally typed, "are busy getting all bent out of shape about this." Carmack was talking about the gaming community's reaction to id's announcement that the first test of their next game, Quake 3 Arena, would be released for Macintosh, not Windows. In the gaming world, this was usually as big as the controversies got. But while Carmack turned his attention to his plan, describing the pros and cons of the new Macintosh systems, he couldn't avoid the other controversy. Finishing his update, he pushed himself away from his desk and walked down the hall to get a Diet Coke and a snack. "Hey," he said, passing the police officers in his lobby, "do you guys want anything to eat?" The cops were the most obvious sign of Columbine's impact on id. They had been hired to stand guard shortly after the first wave of hate calls and hate mails started flaming into the office. Miss Donna, receptionist and id mom, would pick up the phone to find a raging protester on the other end of the line asking what in God's name this company had done. Soon there were journalists hanging around outside, trying fruitlessly to get a word from one of the many long-haired guys walking from their sports cars into the jet-black cube. After a hateful protester was found outside screaming, a few of the newer members of the id staff pleaded for security during the late hours. Carmack and the other owners relented, but felt it was an overreaction. "Oh," they said, "this happens all the time." In fact, it had happened only 8 days before the Columbine shootings. On April 12, 1999, the parents of three students killed in a 1997 school shooting in Paducah, Kentucky, had leveled a $130 million lawsuit against entertainment companies, including id Software, whose violent products, they said, had inspired the 14-year-old murderer, Michael Kerneal, a fan of Doom and Quake. And of course, it had happened long before that. The Wolfenstein controversies in 1992, the Mortal Kombat hearings in 1993, the Doom bans to follow, not to mention the Death Race arcade outrage in the 1970s or the Dungeons & Dragons hysteria in the 80s. As long as these guys had played games, there had been the detractors, the lawsuits, the sensationalism, but nothing quite as powerful as the 1-2 punch of Paducah and Columbine. Because of the Paducah lawsuit, id's lawyers strongly advised the owners and employees to remain quiet. The staff obliged, but Carmack felt frustrated that he couldn't tell the world what he thought. As a result, the media storm brewed and brewed with no word from the people who had made the games. But Carmack knew exactly what he would say. The succession of the two events did not necessarily mean that something more significant was happening or the trend was increasing. It was just the odds. This life event, like every other, could be broken down to mathematics. If you've got any event that has this random chance of happening, eventually, after a certain time, there are going to be multiple occurrences of it quickly after another. Carmack wasn't worried that there was suddenly going to be some secret link exposed between games and murder. Disturbed people are disturbed people, pure and simple. Id's games weren't about really killing someone, Carmack knew. They were just extensions of childhood play. Deathmatch was tag, he said. Doom was cowboys and Indians with better special effects. We build games that we think are going to be fun. All the games we enjoyed, like Defender and Robotron, were all about running around and blasting things. The gore and graphics just make an already challenging and interactive game more visceral. It makes people jump and sweat and be tense. It's an okay game if you're sitting saying, okay, this is fun. But our definition of a good game is something that's going to be gripping and exciting. Were these violent games being marketed to kids? Of course teenagers like our games, Carmack said. To say that our games are targeted only for 18-year-olds and older is ludicrous. But the thing that people weren't getting, he thought, was that id wasn't targeting anyone. All the way back to Soft Disk, they had made games not for an audience, but for themselves. They made games they wanted to play, that no one else was making. Games that, as fate would have it, would appeal to millions of others. As Carmack returned to his desk, he went back to work on a game that was going to be id's most gleeful shooter yet, Quake 3 Arena. But, after Columbine, would people want, would the market allow, his or Romero's games again? John Schuneman gripped his bowling ball tighter as the talk turned to Doom. Romero's stepfather, now in his 60s, had been coming to this bowling alley more frequently since retiring, and he could usually count on relaxing with a good game. But not today. The people next to him, like millions across the country, were talking about the horrific events at Columbine High School. Kids today, they're being corrupted by these violent video games like Doom. Schuneman's heart raced again as they spoke. He stepped over to the group. We can take it outside anytime you want, he said, curling the ball at his side. He didn't want to hear any more trash about Johnny's games. He wasn't the only one. Romero himself couldn't believe the way people were harping on Doom, a game that was 6 years old. It just showed how clueless the politicians had become. It was just the same old crap from the same old people. And Romero was tired of the blame. Those kids were defective, he thought, so don't blame it on my game. Don't blame the games. Blame the fucking parents. From his own experience, of course, Romero had strong opinions about just how parents could screw up their kids. And now, at the age of 31, with three kids of his own, he had become more self-aware of where the violence in his games came from and the effect the violent games could have. He was a fucked-up kid making fucked-up games to deal with the fucked-up physical and emotional violence he'd experienced when he was young. He liked the violence in his games, just as he liked the violence in his Melvin comics. There was no question, the violence in his games did have an impact on him, at least. He'd scream and curse and break keyboards, but he never confused fantasy and reality. He didn't even know how to fire a gun in real life. But because he thought violence in games could have an effect, Romero thought that even more responsibility should rest with the parent. For that reason, he supported ratings on games, as did most of his peers. Ultimately, the responsibility shouldn't be the game makers or the politicians. The parents should decide when their kids were mature enough to play a game like Doom. Romero had long relished the day he could sit down with his boys, Stephen and Michael, and play through the worlds he created. They were ready for that day, Romero decided, when they were 8. After Columbine, though, Romero kept these opinions to himself. He wasn't being sued like id, but why say anything anyway? You talk to journalists, and they're going to take what you say and twist it any way they want into their story, and it will only end up looking bad. The last thing Romero wanted was more bad press. Even before Columbine, after all, he'd been getting more than his share. The avalanche of trash-talking in the press and in the community broke the moment the 8 members of the Daikatana team, or, as they became known, the Ion 8, had walked out Ion Storm's emerald doors a few months earlier, in November 1998. No sooner did Romero lose the core of his team than news broke that the Ion 8 had formed a new company, Third Law, which was under contract to create a first-person shooter based on the rock band Kiss for the Gathering of Developers, the independent-minded publisher started by Mike Wilson after his departure from Ion Storm. It was a double slap to Romero's face. He felt backstabbed by Mike and burned by the team he trusted. It was like the soft disk mutiny in which Romero and the rest had jilted Alvacovius. Only this time, Romero was the boss getting screwed. But Romero, as usual, didn't wait long to change moods. And this time he had someone to help speed his recovery. Stevie Case. Throughout all the darkness at the company, Stevie had been a beacon. They had much in common. Two misfit kids who'd found a home in the fantasy life of video games. And, like Romero, Stevie had radically reinvented herself. Inspired by Ion Storm's creative atmosphere, the small-town girl with the student government bob had transformed her image. She stopped eating meat, went to the gym, lost 50 pounds, bleached her hair. She ditched the sweatshirts for midriffs, the baggy jeans for leopard pants. She used her video game salary to buy breast implants. In the space of a year, she had gone from model tomboy to Playboy model. The magazine, hearing her story, paid her to pose. After the Ion 8 left, she became Romero's lead designer. She also became his girlfriend. Just as he engaged to get Ion back on track, he separated from his wife Beth, not long after she had given birth to their daughter, Lilia. Once again, Romero had grown dissatisfied with his marriage and overwhelmed by the pressures of being a rich person and game god. After all the years of assuring everyone, his fans, his friends, his family, that he could do it all, he had finally realized he could not manage both an empire and a family. His ex-wife, Kelly, had made this point clear when, to Romero's dismay, she moved back to California with his boys. Ultimately, he gave in to the truth. He was married to his games. With Stevie, the first woman in his life who shared the passion, it was a three-way affair. As his personal life changed, Romero put his energy into rebuilding his team, hiring a few old friends and picking up some help from Tom Hall's squad. Though Dai Katana was in need of an overhaul, the end was in sight. The Quake II engine conversion was complete, they announced in early January 1999. A producer Romero had hired to organize Dai Katana proudly told the press that, come hell or high water, the game will be done on February 15th, 1999. Or so the team hoped. Days later, they would receive the worst blow of bad press yet. A scathing cover story called Stormy Weather in the city's free weekly paper, the Dallas Observer. The 7,000-word story explicitly detailed how the place where the designer's vision is king has turned into a toxic mix of prima donnas and personality cults. More shocking, the article was based on internal emails. They now appeared in print and online for the entire world to read. The result, inside and outside the company, was devastating. Suddenly, all of ION's internal affairs, from Mike Wilson's BMW financing to Romero's interest in burning through Eidos's options, was public. Internet sites traded the story as fast as Doom shareware, reveling in how the surgeon of Deathmatch, the one who was going to make them his bitch, was finally getting his due. Romero tried fitfully to determine the source of the leak. He blocked access to game gossip sites and even tried, though unsuccessfully, to sue the Observer to reveal its sources. All he found was that his partner Todd Porter had accidentally posted his email file on a company computer network and that anyone within ION could have copied them. By the time the Columbine blow came, a few months later, Romero couldn't have been beaten down any worse. His company was a laughingstock. His game was once again delayed, with no end in sight, having sailed past the promise for a February 1999 release. It now was in danger of buckling to technology once and for all, with id Software already deep into the Quake 3 engine. When a deathmatch demo of Dai Katana was released in March, gamers thought it looked dated. The dream of the big company seemed to be proving too big after all. Too loose, too high, too ambitious. All those things Carmack had berated him about, the hyperbole, the lack of focus, the dangers of a large team, had come back with a vengeance. Even Eidos, Romero's publisher, agreed. In return for their sinking by now nearly $30 million into the company, Romero had to change his ways once and for all. As the Eidos president Rob Dyer put it, shut up and finish the game. Id Software was once again in the spotlight at the E3 convention in Los Angeles in May 1999, but this time for all the wrong reasons. Coming only 1 month after the Columbine shootings and the Paducah lawsuit, the show became a feeding ground for the media's increasingly sensational investigation of video game violence. Of all the companies the reporters wanted to interview, there was none higher on the list than the creators of Doom and Quake. This wasn't going to be easy. No one, it seemed, wanted to talk about the events. In his opening remarks, Doug Lowenstein, president of the Interactive Digital Software Association, the group that was created in response to Senator Lieberman's 1993 hearings on game violence, tried to set the tone. He pointed out that only 7% of the 5,000 games released were violent enough to be rated mature. Nevertheless, he added, the game industry was in fact growing up. This was not for kids. The IDSA reported that 54% of video gamers were over 18, with 25% of these older than 36. The age of computer gamers was even higher, with 70% over 18 and 40% of them over 36. Together, U.S. gamers were spending nearly $7 billion that year alone, more than Americans spent on movie tickets. For those of you who are here to focus on violence, Lowenstein said, I submit that you're missing a much bigger story about what it is that makes interactive entertainment the fastest growing entertainment industry in the world. The reporters responded by rushing over to Id's booth for comments on Columbine, to no avail. Any journalist who muscled up to one of the gamers from Id was abruptly intercepted by a PR representative, who would refer him or her to the publisher, Activision, who would refuse to say anything at all. These weren't the only gamers laying low. Raven, Id's old friends from Wisconsin, showed their violent shooter, Soldier of Fortune, only behind closed doors. The same was true for one of the year's other hotly anticipated shooters, Kingpin. For Id, however, the controversy was the least of their difficulties. With Quake 3 Arena, the game they had come to demonstrate, they were having enough problems. The trouble started the moment Carmack had announced the previous year that the game's design would be deathmatch only. In light of the success of Half-Life, a shooter in which story was everything, the free-for-all plan sounded heretical, if not out of touch. Others bristled at the notion that Id's next title would be, essentially, its most elitist ever, not just suggesting that a player had a high-end machine, but requiring it by making the game compatible only for players who had 3D graphics cards installed. The fans weren't the only ones in doubt. After the office dysfunction that had surrounded Quake 2, the energy level heading into Quake 3 was at an all-time low. The old battles that Carmack had endured with Romero had been supplanted by the rest of the team. Inspired by Half-Life, everyone, it seemed, wanted a more ambitious design. But no matter what they came up with, Carmack shot it down. For Adrian, it was just more of the same. Further proof that after all these years since their lake house in Shreveport, Id had become Carmack's company. Adrian felt frustrated, wanting to do something, anything that was different. It was a criticism that was starting to bubble up in the community as well. Id was rehashing the same game over and over without any consideration for story and design, but Adrian resigned himself to go along. What was he going to do, he thought, fire John Carmack? As work began on the project, the dissolution only festered. Carmack's intention to create a game that allowed the members of his company to work in, essentially, isolation, proved a bit too isolationist. As he churned out early versions of the Quake 3 engine, the mappers and artists felt adrift, with no direction on what to pursue. Left to their own devices, they simply created their own little worlds, worlds that clearly didn't relate to or complement each other. Carmack grew increasingly frustrated. Here he was, creating the most powerful graphics engine the company had ever seen, and no one on his staff seemed to be taking advantage of the opportunities. No one was pushing the technology, pushing the design, pushing him. Though Carmack never came out and said that he pined for the days of Romero's giddy experimentations, it was clear to him that something was missing. The magic of the self-motivated Id Software team was gone. By February 1999, the staff had had enough. Carmack clearly had no interest in managing the day.